I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Obama is due to receive a report today on why and how U.S. intelligence agencies failed to connect information they had about the Christmas Day bomb suspect. Meanwhile, the administration is beating back stinging criticism from Republicans, including Dick Cheney, who excoriated what he called the president's low-key response to the incident. Democrats pointing out that President Bush didn't respond to the alleged shoe bomber for a full week. While that bickering continues, what more do we know about what intelligence officials knew? Mark Mazzetti covers the CIA for the New York Times. Mark, you're reporting about text messages and intercepts. Tell us more.
Well, as we report in the story today, the first sign of a threat came in August when the National Security Agency, which is responsible for all global electronic eavesdropping for the U.S. government, picked up some conversations between al-Qaeda leaders in Yemen who talked about a Nigerian, not using a name, being prepared for some kind of an attack. The intercepts were translated. They were then disseminated, fed into the intelligence network in the United States.
Yeah.
That becomes one data point of a threat. And as we chronicle in the story today, there were other data points that came up along the way in the 4 months since leading up to Christmas Day, when the young Nigerian stepped on a plane and intended to blow it up.
Well, another point was texts that the father of the suspect received from his son. Tell us about those.
Yes. Starting in October, the father of Mr. Abdulmutallab began receiving text messages from his son, who had gone to Yemen and began associating with radicals in that country.
Do we have a sense of what the son talked about generally in those text messages?
The text messages talked about how he was basically leaving the life that he was raised in and going on to a sort of a purer form of Islam and take on the life of a radical Islamist.
Well, and at this point in your story, the father of the suspect then begs American diplomats in Nigeria and CIA agents there as well to help find his son. And here's where the questions arise. I mean, we are used to a Google lifestyle, a Google culture. So the thinking of most Americans is at this point in the story, somebody types into some sort of database, Nigerian and Yemen, and comes up with, you know, the first intercepts that you talked about, al-Qaeda operatives in Yemen talking about using a Nigerian, and a father talking about his Nigerian son who's gone to Yemen. Do we know if something like that happens at the National Counterterrorism Center?
You're exactly right that that connection seems to us like something that should have obviously been made. We do not believe that there was any computer software or any computer program that made that connection and then presented it to an intelligence analyst. And we're still trying to figure out exactly why that the August intercepts weren't connected with the November information that the father provided.
Right.
And so that is one of the key questions. And talking to intelligence officials yesterday, we heard that the way the system works right now is a lot of information gets fed into these databases, but it requires an analyst to sort of frequently do these searching, or what they call in the intelligence community deep dives into a subject to then piece the information together himself or herself. So it's not like it's a Google alert where the computer puts the things together and spits them out. Although I'm sure that in certain cases they do have this kind of software.
Right.
But in this case, the connections weren't made.
So can we assume that this is going to be one of the things that's going to be looked at going forward?
Yes, certainly. You know, the question is it a human error where the person, because of this myriad information coming in, was not able to piece these things together? Or was it really that the connections were very obvious and someone fell asleep at the switch or several people fell asleep at the switch? But it does raise these very central questions of, okay, here we are 8 years after September 11th. We've created two whole agencies, the Department of Homeland Security and the Directorate of National Intelligence, to fix the problems of 9/11 and spent billions of dollars. And why are we still having these problems?
Well, don't we understand as well that CIA officials in Nigeria sent a cable to headquarters in Langley, Virginia, labeled Visa Viper? You report that that should indicate that there was a warning about terrorism. What does that mean, Visa Viper?
Well, there's actually two separate things that happened. When the father went to the embassy in Nigeria and talked to CIA and State Department officials, a couple things happened. First of all, the State Department sent out this Visa Viper cable, which basically is a it's not a revoking of a person's visa, but it is a sort of information that could flag a potential problem. It didn't raise the issue up to someone being on a no-fly list or revoking their visa, but it is a cable that goes into the system about a specific individual. Separately, the CIA did a cable that where they gathered more biographical information about the young man and his background and maybe some of his intentions in Yemen. That cable was sent to CIA headquarters, and as far as we know, was not shared with the rest of the intelligence community. And this is where the sort of second-guessing and finger-pointing comes in, because different intelligence agencies are assigning blame to the other ones as being responsible for not sharing or not properly putting the dots together. So some are blaming the CIA for not widely sharing that cable, and they're saying if they had some more of information that was in that cable, they might have then sort of triggered a deep dive into the man, which would have ultimately put him on a no-fly list.
Well, and meanwhile, we know that some people in intelligence are saying, you know, it's not fair to say nothing's changed since 9/11 because of this incident. There's something called a death penalty for not sharing information.
Well, the mantra in the intelligence community is share, right? You have to share information. And to be fair, in this case, despite this instance of the CIA, it is not a pure parallel to 9/11 where no one was sharing information with each other, and that led to directly missing glaring clues to the 9/11 plot. In this case, a lot was shared and was fed into the system, but it's a problem more of taking disparate pieces of information and putting them together and having so much information that maybe it's impossible to see the big picture.
Mark Mazzetti, national security correspondent for The New York Times. Mark, thanks as always. And boy, the old year is going out, you know, on a kind of a foreboding note, but happiest of New Year's to you.
Yeah, Happy New Year to you.
Well, reading our next guest's recent essay in New York Magazine was as wild a ride as the decade he was writing about, the one we're about to leave behind. It started with the Y2K panic. Remember that? Then 9/11, traveling on through wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, Hurricane Katrina, and that global economic collapse Y2Kers predicted would happen at the beginning of the decade. Well, that came 9 years later. Nearly 6 in 10 people surveyed recently by NBC and The Wall Street Journal said the past 9 years were either awful or not so good. Of course, there were advances, the first African-American president, the rise of high-speed internet access. But cultural commentator Michael Hirschhorn writes that that last thing may be part of the problem. The internet leveled the playing field, but has led to a fear that no one is in charge, and that's why we're all screaming at each other. Michael is the owner of Ish Entertainment, a TV production company. He's also contributing editor to The Atlantic Monthly, but wrote his article on the aughts for New York Magazine. Welcome, Michael.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
Well, as I said, wildly entertaining read, but at times... Well, here's a letter to the editor that came afterwards. A reader writes, "Subcontracting our lives to the digital cloud." What the hell does that mean? What do you mean?
Well, I think that the decade had some very clear winners and some very clear losers. And I think that it was generational, mostly, but not entirely. For the most part, younger people understood this idea that they would connect their lives to the digital grid, I mean, otherwise known as the digital cloud. Mm. Just this idea that if you think about Twitter and you think about Facebook and you think about YouTube, the way younger people in general, not exclusively, but in general, lead their lives is materially different than the way that older people lead their lives, the way that we all led it in the past. And I think that there's sort of a rough divide between analog living and digital living. And digital living generally means that you're sharing more and more of your identity and yourself with the public.
Well, and one result of this is that, you write, it wipes out the gatekeepers and everything from media to investment banking to marketing and sales. And you point to rapper Kid Cudi, who recorded a song that just, you know, bounced around on the web and then made it to MTV. He sort of did it himself. He was one of those, as you call it, people who became a brand of one.
Kid Cudi was part of a surprising number of indie rock bands and rappers who really came of age in Brooklyn, who operated pretty much on a kind of DIY basis. They created their own music using some of the Pro Tools and other sort of cheap production that really you could just get on your Mac. And the music was also distributed in a different way. They would put it themselves out on YouTube or just sort of send it around to friends. And in the case of Day and Night, which is probably, to me, one of the great songs of the decade, that was a song that just kicked around the internet for more than a year. And then it started getting discovered by people. It appeared on some mixtapes and then ultimately ended up in video rotation. And he was picked up by a label. And it took almost 2 years for that song to actually appear on a CD. His first album came out in late 2009. 'Cause day and night, the lonest loner seems to free his mind at night. He's all alone through the day and night. The lonely loner seems to free his mind at night. At night. Day and night, the lonest loner seems to free his mind at night.
Well, and so young people would say, yeah, and what's the problem with that?
Yeah, I'm pretty optimistic on the music front in general, because I think, you know, the old way in which music reached us was, you know, there was a handful of music labels, and in the past decade, 15 years or so, the number of labels became smaller and smaller and smaller. So you had a handful of gatekeepers who wielded inordinate amounts of power. And what happened, you know, really starting with Napster at the start of the decade, was that monopoly was broken down, and the amount of music that was created as a result exploded.
So people who go digital might be the winners of the decade. You call them the hustlers, the brands of one. Who are the losers?
Well, I think my piece in a way was directed at the losers. The losers are the people that are persisting in operating in the old way. And I think the losers already are most of Wall Street, probably the major political parties, the mainstream media, the mainstream entertainment business, Hollywood, certainly newspapers and magazines.
Video stores?
Video stores, record stores. I mean, it's interesting because you're already seeing things like Xbox and Wii and things of that nature that would presumably be winners. They're already looking like losers because kids, and certainly my kids are an example, have stopped using their Wii and now just want to, you know, play new games, you know, that are apps that are created by random people that show up on their iPhone search.
Yeah, kids who have just gotten their Wii this Christmas will enjoy it for a while, but then, yeah, they're going to want their apps. They're going to want more apps for their Wii. They're going to want their PSP Go instead of their PSP.
Exactly. Yeah. And I just noticed there was a website that went up fairly recently called Ustream. It's basically you just real-time stream yourself, and I'm calling that the next Twitter. That's the next scary thing.
That's writer Michael Hirshhorn. So what do Glenn Beck and composer Osvaldo Golohov tell us about the decade past? We'll ask him that next. And later, start thinking about your favorite films of this past decade. See if they match our critic Ty Burr's list. Back in a minute, here and now. When the temple slows up and creates that new, new. He seems alive, though he is feeling blue. The sun is shining, man, he's super cool. The lonely nights, they fade away, he slips into his white nights.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to our discussion about the last 10 years with Michael Hirshhorn, a contributing editor to the Atlantic Monthly. His article on the aughts recently appeared in New York Magazine. And Michael, you've been telling us about how the center and authority has exploded. But draw the line for us from that to fear, because you say the sense of blowing away the old order created fear and ultimately led to those town hall screaming matches.
Right. Well, I think that a lot of the hysteria you see on the right now is an expression of fear. You see fevered reaction, and sometimes that reaction can become very powerful. So in a time of change, there's always a backlash, and the people that see themselves as being losers in this time of change are not going to sit by quietly. And that's why you see the Glenn Becks of the world. And really what it is an expression of fear of change.
Well, and you know that people who follow Glenn Beck and Lou Dobbs would say, that's a bunch of hooey. I just agree with them politically. I'm not afraid of anything. Another reader who writes into New York Magazine after your article says, this is the same old look at what they've done to us clop that you're just writing from the left and, you know, painting the right as being reactionary.
Well, I think you see some of it on the left as well. Yes, I'm definitely consider myself a liberal, but I don't see much problem with mainstream Republican points of view. I think what's interesting, you know, is the conspiracy theories and the hysteria and the extremism of the far right and the traction that that clearly has.
Well, and another reason they might have traction, in your view, is that we move from truth to truthiness. Of course, that's the Stephen Colbert word, meaning something, you know, sort of you feel it in your gut, but it's not based on evidence or fact. Can we have more truthiness because the center has collapsed? You know, authority has collapsed.
Yeah, I think when you know, certainly when I was coming of age in the 70s and 80s, it was basically assumed that if Dan Rather said it on CBS or if it was in the New York Times, that it was true. And what you saw over the last 10, 20 years, there's the sense that there's no referee anymore that's going to tell us what is true. And so into that vacuum comes truthiness. And I think Colbert was, you know, incredibly prescient. He really sort of captured, you know, the tenor of the moment, which is that we're not only fighting over policy, but we're fighting over what is fact. And in an internet age, there really isn't anyone to definitively tell us what is true and what's not. And I think, in a way, that's probably the scariest, because we're at a moment when nobody has really stepped into the breach to kind of define for us what reality is. And especially in a digital age, it's very easy to fake that. And that's why you're seeing a lot of hoaxes, you're seeing a lot of fraud, you're seeing a lot of smart people using conspiracy and scare tactics to create movements based on information that may or may not be true, or that may be partly true, but which is sort of amplified to an extent that makes it kind of dangerous.
So, Michael Hirshhorn, you say that the aughts was a decade that was transformational into a potentially very exciting democratic world, but also into a scary no-one's-in-charge world.
Well, yes, I think it's very helpful, because I mean, when I was thinking about this piece, and I'm not sure metaphor is the right word, but I think that we moved from a kind of center, top-down world in which there was a central authority into a world in which everything has been shot to the margins, and in which a lot more people have power and influence, and in which who gets that power and influence is constantly up for grabs and changing. So for the people that are excited by that and motivated by that, it's an exciting time. For people who are afraid of that, it's a terrifying time. And I think what was interesting is that metaphor of the center exploding literally happened on 9/11. And I think that Al-Qaeda actually understood that in a way, because Al-Qaeda is basically a social network. It's like Facebook. It's like Twitter. It's a matrixed, it doesn't have a location. It's an idea. And when you think about the 23-year-old who tried to blow up the flight into Detroit, his connections to Al-Qaeda were, who knows? You know, he didn't really need to have any. And so I think you're fighting this kind of ghost enemy. And it's not really clear, if you think in kind of more traditional terms, how to act. And if you're the government, who do you attack? It's just that the world has changed in such a fundamental way that we have to start thinking about the world, not only about culture, but the world and culture and politics and ourselves in a different way than we used to.
Michael Hirshhorn writes about the aughts in New York Magazine. By the way, Michael, the title of the article is The Ferality Show. When I think of something that's feral, I think of like wild cats. What does that title mean?
I think The Ferality Show really suggests that, you know, as everything is being shot to the margins and we're all being forced to rely on ourselves, we all have to become a little bit more feral. We just can't depend on institutions, governments, our employers, anybody to take care of us. So I think it's a little bit more of an animal decade.
Well, and I just have to have one last response, because another reader of your article wrote to say, wait a second, you know, look for something, pay attention to what's really important. The field of chemistry, discoveries previously undreamed of. Argentinian composer Osvaldo Golijov's music, you know, and others would say faith. So there are people who maybe don't feel as feral as you do.
Well, I think referring to the composer in question, his music is plenty feral.
Yeah, there you go. Okay.
And that might be why he's having his moment.
Right, and let's go out with some of that. Michael Hirshhorn, also owner of Ish Entertainment, a television production company, and contributing editor to The Atlantic Monthly, will link to his article in New York Magazine at our website, herenow.org. Michael, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Best of the decade, the Kaddish from Golijov's The Passion According to St. Mark. News is next, here and now. You may be among the millions ready to raise an end-of-year glass of hydroalcoholic solution supersaturated with carbon dioxide molecules and laced with proteins, lipids, and amino acids. That's how research scientists see champagne. And they have also discovered that there are 20 million bubbles in one bottle, each of them doing something that alters the taste, smell, and behavior of the bubbly. Robert Lee Hotz is science columnist for The Wall Street Journal. Champagne owes much of its magic to carbon dioxide, CO2. Scientists also identify CO2 as one of the greenhouse gases, but you say champagne is the drinkable greenhouse gas, kind of CO2 light. And you say it's pumped into soft drinks in the factory, but happens in champagne. With a second round of fermentation in tightly sealed bottles, carbon dioxide is already there?
For a long time, as a product of fermentation, yeast metabolizes sugar and produces alcohol, and as a byproduct, carbon dioxide. And for hundreds of years, this was a huge nuisance to winemakers, and their bottles would be exploding. Winemaking was quite a hazardous art. And in the 17th century, starting around then, they began to see the virtue in these bubbles, and slowly and incrementally they figured out ways to keep the bottles from exploding, adopting things like the cork or the wire collar that holds things in.
Well, will you understand from your article that the legendary monk Dom Perignon, who was originally hired to try to get the bubbles out of the champagne, was the one who invented that wire. Is it called a mucilet?
Dom Perignon is an iconic figure in the history of Champagne. The truth is, who knows what he really did, but he was generally credited with a lot of little innovations, the most important one being the prototype of the mucilet, which everybody finds on a bottle. And that's basically what keeps it popping, because there's so much carbon dioxide inside a bottle of champagne that when that cork pops, if you don't do it right, it comes out at about 30 miles an hour, so it could really break the window.
You'll put your eye out.
Right.
Well, and we learn from, again, your writing that if you get it to pop out softer, you have a better taste.
Mm-hmm.
And that the glass has a lot to do with all of this, not just the shape of the glass, the flute, which encourages the bubbles better, but these microscopic pieces of lint or fabric that are in every glass. How do they help the bubbles?
Well, I have to admit, that was part that I found extraordinary, because the crucial cradle for champagne bubbles, it turns out, are these tiny microscopic fibers, typically cellulose, left by the towel that you wiped the glass clean with, or they just simply drift out of the air. They're hollow. As you pour the champagne into the glass, it splashes, some of the gas starts to effervesce, and it's trapped inside these little hollow tubes. And once the glass starts to settle, these little tubes start leaking bubbles, and they do it at a very fixed rate, about 30 bubbles a second. And this is the part that the scientists really zoned in on with high-speed microphotography and mass spectrometry and laser tomography. Each one of these bubbles, when it reaches the surface, explodes like a little bubble of lava, and it shoots these little jet droplets out into the air at several yards per second. I mean, it's pretty fast. And if you're a good champagne drinker, you probably have got your snoot down there in the glass, and these little jet droplets are aerating your nose and your tongue and your lips with aromatic molecules. It's a kind of a delivery system for the quite a lot of the flavor and aroma of champagne. And this is unusual, and it's part of what makes champagne special.
Well, and it's part of what increases your tastes. Your taste buds are activated by the fizz. And you write, if you want the full effect, don't wear lipstick or eat chips.
That's right, because it turns out that you can actually taste carbonated bubbles. People have always thought that this tingle you get on your tongue is just simply from the physical act of these bubbles popping, right? It's like mm-hmm. having a little champagne fairy tap dancing on your tongue. The fact is, though, that the carbonated bubbles actually activate the sour taste receptors. Now, nobody has a clue as to why this should be, because if you think about it, there's no reason why we would have evolved to have a special apparatus for tasting champagne bubbles. So it's probably a side effect of our normal taste sensory apparatus.
Robert Lee Hotz, science columnist for the Wall Street Journal, on the science of the CO2 bubbles in your champagne. But you also remind us of the romantic side of the drink. I'm thinking of a quote from Lord Byron. He called those bubbles foaming whirls as white as Cleopatra's pearls. Dom Perignon said it was like tasting stars. Lee Hotz, thanks so much.
Thank you. Happy New Year.
Same to you and to all of you. Back in 30 seconds here and now. As this first decade of the 21st century draws to a close, we want you to think for a minute, what would you say were the 10 best films of the past 10 years? I'll wait. See, we found it hard. It's not like there was a Godfather or a Chinatown or an E.T., but there was a WALL-E and a Lord of the Rings and a Serious Man. A Serious Man? Yes. This year's film from the Coen brothers, starring Michael Stuhlbarg as physics professor Larry Gopnik, beset by a series of crises that drive him to seek spiritual guidance, made Boston Globe film critic Ty Burr's list of the decade's best. Here's a scene in which Larry pleads with the rabbi's receptionist to let him in.
This is not a frivolous request. This is a I've tried to be a serious man, you know? Tried to do right, be a member of the community, raise the... Danny, Sarah, they both go to school, Hebrew school, a good breakfast. Well, Danny goes to Hebrew school. Sarah doesn't have time. She mostly washes her hair. Apparently, there are several steps involved, but you don't have to tell Marshak that. Just tell him I need help. Please, I need help.
Film critic Ty Burr joins us in the studio. Welcome, as always, but I got to say, I'm hearing people say, a serious man? Are you serious, man?
You know, I am, but I'm also not. It's great to be back here, Robin, but let me tell you something. I don't mind doing the 10 best of the year, but when it comes to doing the 10 best of the decade, I rebel against the tyranny of lists.
This was your editor's idea.
This was my editor's idea, and I had a metaphorical gun to my head. And, you know, I picked 10 movies that, to me, matter to me, because it's always, these things are parlor games, and it's always going to be a personal list.
But a lot of people didn't catch A Serious Man, so tell us why we should.
Well, I wanted to put one from this year, knowing that, you know, 10 years from now, we may look back and say, this one didn't age, you know, or maybe it did. You really can't tell what matters until 10, 20 years down the line. So I wanted to be a little provocative. Why I like this movie, I think it's the Coen brothers finally getting personal. I think it's a great work of comic pessimism. I think it makes a lot of viewers uncomfortable. I don't mind that. I think we live in a pop culture that does everything it can to make us as comfortable as possible, sometimes too much so.
Well, do me a favor. You've got a list there, not just of the top 10, but like of 30, I think, that you really like of the last decade.
You know, I actually went down and everything that mattered to me. I came up with a list of 33. And it includes my top 10, but I put it in an alphabetical order. Can I read it?
Please, give us just a bunch.
Okay. 4 months, 3 weeks, and 2 days. The 25th Hour, A Serious Man, Before Sunset, Borat.
Whoa, stop there. Borat?
Yes.
Okay, defend that.
Defend that. I think it is great American satire. I think it's rude. Talk about a movie that pushes your comfort zone. I think it's a movie that gets right-thinking filmgoers in an absolute dither because it just goes in places that you're not supposed to go. But I think it says something about both how we Americans want to be perceived as open-hearted, democratic people and how we Americans sometimes are when we think the people that we're talking to accept our beliefs. I think it's actually it's a very, very rude film. Again, that's not necessarily a bad thing, but I think it strikes almost every point it hits. I will defend that as being a crucial movie of this decade.
Okay, made in 2006, of course, Sacha Baron Cohen playing Borat from allegedly Kazakhstan, the name of the film, Cultural Learnings of America, For Make Benefit, Glorious Nation of Kazakhstan, part documentary, some real Americans reacting to this incredible character. Let's listen to a clip.
So what that means is this feminism?
It's the theory that women should be equal to men in matters economic,
now,
social,
you are laughing.
Yeah.
Political.
That is the problem.
Do you think a woman should be educated?
Definitely.
But is it not a problem that a woman have a smaller brain than a man?
That is wrong.
But the government scientist, Dr. Yamak, have proved it is size of squirrel.
Your government scientist?
So Dr. Yamak.
He's wrong.
So Borat makes Ty Burr's list. Just give us a few more.
I'm continuing down my list. Broken Flowers, Children of Men, Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, The Diving Bell and the Butterfly, Grizzly Man, I'm Not There.
That's the 2007 film in which six actors play Bob Dylan, and they include Cate Blanchett, who, as we can hear in this clip, just channels Bob Dylan from the 60s.
Who cares what I think? I'm not the president. I'm just a storyteller, man. That's all I am.
Well, I presume at the very least that you care something about what you sing every night.
Are you... How can I answer that if you got the nerve to ask me?
You know, I am convinced of one thing. You either do truly care about nothing at all, or tremendously much that people think so.
And you ask for my time?
The Incredibles, In the Mood for Love, Kill Bill Volume 2, not one.
Okay, Kill Bill. Uh-huh. Also, you went past The Incredibles. Mm-hmm. Now,
well, this was the Pixar decade.
Yeah. Tell us more about that, animated movies and your thoughts about
well,
it.
Well, this was the year, this was the decade that Pixar came to a sense of its absolute mastery of digital animation with soul, and you had a lot of imitators, but nobody able to get the originality and the heart and the soul and the creativity and the wit that the people who, under John Lasseter, who runs Pixar, are able to get in their movies time and time and time again.
What about WALL-E, the Pixar film about the robot who's left alone to clean up the garbage after humans leave Earth? Here's a little of him puttering around.
Wow.
Shouldn't WALL-E make a WALL-E, top 10 list?
WALL-E is on my top 33
okay.
list. When it came to animation, I mean, I love Pixar, but I also have a special place in my heart for the Japanese animation giant Hayao Miyazaki, who actually, ironically, is somebody that John Lasseter of Pixar reveres. And Miyazaki did some of his best work this decade, and a movie like Spirited Away, which is this completely gonzo Japanese variation on Alice in Wonderland, is to me, you know, Pixar couldn't have made that movie. Nobody could have made that movie except this one singular genius.
Give us some more of the Pixar, just for parents who are always poking around.
Oh, God, WALL-E. I think almost everything they did except Cars. Cars is the one that I would kind of throw out of the bunch. But Ratatouille?
Ratatouille?
Yeah.
What about Monsters, Inc.?
Monsters, Inc. is terrific.
Yeah.
Hilarious movie.
Yeah.
I think they've gotten a little more Baroque and getting into unusual plots and taking more chances over the course of the decade.
We've been talking to Boston Globe film critic Ty Burr. By the way, to see both his 10 best and 33 best film lists, and there's a few others that he threw in, go to our website, hereandnow.org, where you can also listen to some of our stories about some of the films we've been talking about. We'll have more with Ty after a break. 1 minute, Here and Now. We're speaking with Boston Globe film critic Ty Burr about his picks for the best films of the entire decade. He started with 33. When his editors asked him to narrow it down, he kicked and screamed, but got it down to 10. And we'll have all of his lists and picks at our website, hereandnow.org. And Ty, director Peter Jackson just dominated the box office in the early part of this mm-hmm. decade with his Lord of the Rings trilogy. You picked one of those, The Two Towers. It came out in 2002. Let's just listen to a clip. This is actor Andy Serkis playing Gollum.
He wants it. He needs it. Must have the precious. They stole it from us. Sneaky little hobbitses. Wicked, Fritzy first.
And by the way, at our website, herenow.org, we'll link you to our interview with Andy Serkis talking about playing computer-generated characters. But why Two Towers, Tiber?
Incidentally, that may be one of the great vocal performances of the decade. Why Two Towers? Well, I mean, I wanted to get something of blockbuster Hollywood filmmaking in there. And sometimes some of that blockbuster filmmaking can be so cynical. But Peter Jackson approached the Tolkien books with reverence and a lot of imagination as far as creating this world out of a combination of New Zealand and digital animation. To my mind, the one movie of the trilogy in which everything clicks is the middle film, The Two Towers. He's not concerned with introducing the characters and telling the story. In the third film, he's got so many endings, he's got it wrapped up. The movie actually ends up kind of going on a little too long. But to my mind, The Two Towers is a perfect example of Hollywood blockbuster craftsmanship. This one, everything comes together, and it really is something to see.
But on the opposite end of the spectrum in the past decade, you've said that this has been an unparalleled era for nonfiction films. You had one on your list, 2008's Man on Wire, the documentary directed by James Marsh about high-wire artist Philip Petit, his 1974 crossing of the Twin Towers. That's interesting. Really, we went from towers to towers. And, of course, the towers we see in the documentary take on extra power. Let's listen just to a quick clip from Man on Wire.
It's clearly impossible not only to walk across this, I have probably hardly thought of it, but to bring almost like a ton of equipment secretly, to rig a wire for hours, to guideline it. It's clearly out of human scale.
But so, Tiber, you know, just talk for a second about nonfiction films.
Well, I think that this decade was a wonderful period for nonfiction films for the very obvious reason that the equipment is now so cheap, so portable, that anybody can go out there and film their life or film a subject that interests them. And in fact, that's what happened in the past decade. You had films like Spellbound or Capturing the Freedmans, in which a guy went out to make a movie about kids' party clowns and ended up making a documentary about the backstory of one of the party clowns, which his family upbringing, you know, was a drama beyond any fictional story could come up with.
I don't think that just because there were things in his life that were private and secret and shameful, that means that
No.
the father who I knew and the things I knew about him were in any way not real.
Well, give us a few more films from your list.
Where was I? I think it was in the M's. The Magdalene Sisters, Man on Wire, which we've talked about, Master and Commander.
Yeah.
Again, wonderful craftsmanship.
We'll have Tiber's list at our website, the entire 33-film list of the best films of the decade, but we want to mention a couple. Look, we've looked at other film critics' lists as well, and there are movies that, you know, might have been difficult for some people, like Sideways from 2004.
Well, for one thing, I think Hollywood caters to younger audiences, and here's a movie about two middle-aged buddies trying to rekindle their college bonhomie, and it just fails in every conceivable comic way as they stagger across the wine country of California. I think if you are a guy getting up in years and you look at, you know, your best friends from college and the places you've gone, this can be a painfully funny movie. And Paul Giamatti giving one of the performances of the decade.
I don't think somebody really takes the time to understand Pino's potential can then coax it into its fullest expression. And then, I mean, oh, its flavors, they're just the most haunting and brilliant and thrilling and subtle and ancient on the planet.
Well, in the very last film we wanted to ask you about, The Pianist, however one says that, the 2002 film, it's by Roman Polanski. And
oh,
it's just such a reminder, you know, he's got legal troubles, of course, now. And here, it's just a reminder of maybe why, as some would see it, he got away with what he got away with. I mean, he can make films.
Well, if you can divorce what he did, and I'm not saying you should forgive what he did or forget what he did, from his true genius as a filmmaker, this film does stand as one of the great films of the decade and certainly one of the great Holocaust films in that it uses the Holocaust in a tragic, ironic way telling the story, the true story of a man, an artist, a pianist, played by Adrian Brody, who literally sits out World War II from the middle of the conflict, hiding, watching, living, surviving to play again. It's about what the artist's duty is in a time of conflict. It's to survive, to be able to bring beauty into the world after it's over. To me, this is one of Polanski's most personal film because he's drawing on emotions that he, you know, went through himself as a child during World War II, but it also hooks into much larger issues, and I think it's a movie that's really going to hold up many, many years.
That's Boston Globe film critic Ty Burr. We've dragged him kicking and screaming to the end of the decade to, and forced him, as his editors did, to give a list of the decade's best films.
Can I mention my Z movie?
Please tell us your Z movies.
Zodiac. David Fincher's Zodiac. Again, a difficult movie, but one that will last.
Okay. To see Ty's entire list, go to our website, hereandnow.org. Ty, thanks as always. You're done.
I am done. Thanks, Robin. Onward into the next decade.
If you're under clear skies tonight in America, you'll see an orb to rival the crystal ball at Times Square. It's the so-called blue moon, the second full moon in 1 month, which happens on average every 2.5 years, but only every 19 years on New Year's Eve. It isn't actually blue, and a blue moon isn't technically the second full moon in a month. Kelly Beatty is senior contributing editor for Sky and Telescope magazine, and Kelly, your magazine is responsible for this misunderstanding.
Yes, we'll take the hit for that. Back in 1946, we ran an article where an author said, well, there's two moons in this particular month, and I interpret that to mean that that's where the meaning of blue moon came from. Right. Once in a blue moon, once a rare event. But in fact, the blue moon traces back to 1937 in the Maine Farmer's Almanac, of all places, where it intended to mean the third of four full moons in a single season.
Right. It's an extra moon in a whole season, not just a month.
That's right.
Right. Well, is there any scientific significance?
Not at all, except that it reminds us that there's this kind of clockwork in the cosmos that goes on all the time. And every once in a while, these little curiosities, like two full moons in a month, happen. And they're fun to watch. It's too bad that it's going to be cloudy tonight, because if I saw that moon rising, I'd probably look up and howl.
But what about any other meaning? You know, it's the end of a decade.
Well, that's true. And, you know, those who are looking for conspiracies and portents, tonight not only is there a full moon, it's not only the end of a decade and maybe a blue moon, but in the Eastern Hemisphere, you might see a partial lunar eclipse as well.
We're all doomed. Kelly Beatty, a senior contributing editor for Sky and Telescope magazine. I prefer to see it as something lighting our way into the future.
Good thought, Robin. Happy New Year to you.
Same to you.